Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we welcome one of the industry's most revered film directors, Mr. Jonathan Demme. This Academy Award-winning director has helmed classic films like Melvin and Howard, Something Wild, The Silence of the Lambs, and Philadelphia. He's also made a mark in the realm of documentary filmmaking. His 1984 classic, Stop Making Sense, is widely regarded as the greatest concert film ever made. His latest documentary also revolves around the world of music, in this case, world musician Enzo Avitabile. The film, titled Enzo Avitabile, Music Life, is currently playing in New York City and opens up in Los Angeles on October 25th. For future play dates and cities, visit EnzoAvitabileMusicLife.com. We spoke with Mr. Demme on the day of the release in New York City last Friday. Let's talk about this new film. What fascinates me about documentary filmmaking, because you've made such a mark, particularly in music documentaries, what fascinates me about the process is you could have a concept of what you want, but that constantly evolves as you're in the process of making it. So I'm curious to know, when you teamed up with Enzo, what was your concept of what you wanted this movie to be, and how did it redefine itself as you were putting it together?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. Well, I guess, you know, over the years, it seems that I've done a number of documentaries, portrait documentaries, in addition to other kind of documentaries. And I've also done a number of music performance films. The documentaries, so seeing this one as a documentary, you know, what I need, and I think what's necessary to proceed with a documentary, which is an unscripted filming experience, is a subject that that the filmmaker, me, that I think is incredibly interesting, and that I have faith that by traveling to this person, whether that means traveling up to 125th Street to film my cousin years ago, who was a radical minister up in Harlem, or go to Naples to film Enzo Avitabile, I'm convinced that getting to know this person on film will result in a film that will be, you know, worth seeing. So because I loved Enzo's music so much, this opportunity kind of offered both a documentary portrait of somebody that I found inspiring, and also a chance to do a music performance film and to do kind of a hybrid of them. So I just sort of showed up trusting in Enzo, trusting that he'd be interesting and trusting that his music would be great performed live with all these wonderful musicians, and hoping to, you know, that in that 1 week visit, to kind of get a sense of who this guy is whose music I've come to love so much.
Mm-hmm. And that's really, I find, very difficult. Even when you're dealing with narrative portraits of musicians, I think it's difficult to kind of capture where their art comes from and the creative process itself. What are the challenges of being able to capture that on film for you?
Well, it's true what you say, but I think that's that kind of question has to be seen through a prism of relative to how much do you expect, how much do you need. This film is like going to visit Enzo Avitabile on the occasion of a week of recording sessions that he's doing with guest musicians who've come to see him. So I did not approach it with, like, I want to find out everything about this guy. I'm not going to ask him a ton of questions. I actually don't like asking documentary subjects any questions. I like kind of being there in the moment and hearing what comes up. I may ask the occasional question, but if I go to Enzo's apartment to spend several hours with him under those circumstances, I'm excited to see him in his natural habitat and see what he chooses to kind of share with me and with the viewer, rather than going there with an agenda of, I'm going to find out, you know, this. I'm not looking for, frankly, looking for in-depth. I'm looking for in the moment. I like in depth and what have you, but that wasn't the agenda here. This was like hanging with Enzo. I know there's things about, like, for example, at a certain point when we're visiting him, he talks about, in the middle of a whole rant about the joys of composing at home on a computer, you know, there's a moment when he said, you know, I went blind years ago, and I had to stop writing, and then I had a corneal transplant, and I could see again, and I brought my renewed vision to this work, composing on the computer. Well, I'm curious about, wow, what's it like to lose your sight? What was that like? And then you regain your sight. I'm curious about that stuff, but honestly, for a piece like this, I don't think we have time for it. I think it's kind of mind-blowing that he lost his sight. Extraordinary that through a corneal transplant he got his sight back, that this brought a renewed kind of energy to his composing. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Now let's hear some more music.
Yeah, exactly. And the music that you do capture here, I mean, you photograph the musicians and their particular skills and interactions so beautifully. Is there any danger of being too obtrusive because you're there with their camera? I mean, you want to be kind of in a certain way, I'm sure you want to be in the moment, so you want to be in like a fly on the wall to capture what they're doing. But can you intrude too much in that process? Is there danger of that?
I think that there's probably always that possibility, and that's one of the giant questions that hovers over documentary filmmaking in every form. Is what we see happening conceivably because there's a camera there? Are people behaving and expressing themselves in ways that actually they probably never would absent a camera? This is one of the great mind-boggling questions that documentary filmmakers, well, that I try not to even think about too much, and I do try to be unobtrusive and a fly on the wall. And in this situation, we had a very small crew, very discreet crew, very excellent crew, and we were working with Enzo's sound team and the two superb camera people, one from Italy, one from Brooklyn, who came with me. And, you know, honestly, our thing was that we are now collaborating with the musicians. We are part of the creativity that's going on here now. We're members of the band, but our job isn't to create the music, it's to capture the music. So that's really a part of what I love. I mean, there's a lot of moments in the film where you can see the different camera people either scurrying into a new position, and then it might cut to the shot that they're now getting, or you can see them with their camera on a tripod or on a dolly across the room. And I like that. It's sort of, you know, as we know, one of the basic rules with filmmaking is you know, it's a sin to see another camera. It's a sin to see a microphone. It reminds the people, the viewer, that there was a movie being made. But for me, it's like, yeah, you know, that's right. There was a movie being made. It's the one you're watching now, for better or for worse. So I loved the idea of making even the shots of the crew part of the reality that we were filming, and kind of to try to really, I guess, in the cutting room, illustrate the fact that we were working in harmony, and we were visually nurturing this session along.
Yeah, and it really does show you that, I mean, the filmmakers themselves are part of the chemistry of that environment, and it creates a different level to it, I think. Speaking of environment, Naples. Tell me the importance of Naples and what it expresses about Enzo's particular art.
Well, I had this sort of idea of Naples as being what? A folksy, old-fashioned Italian city. I'd never really known very much about it. I hadn't really heard that much about it. You know, you're about Neapolitan ice cream, you know, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, or the fabulous Neapolitan pizzas. You hear about that sometime. And you know that Naples has a bird's eye view of the island of Pompeii and Mount Vesuvius, and that's interesting. But what the heck is Naples? You hear that that there are giant garbage strikes sometimes through the media, and you there's that great film about, I guess, 8 or 10 years ago, the title of which will probably elude me, that kind of showed the extraordinary presence of the kind of the Naples Mafia. Do you know what film I'm talking about? Do you remember that title?
No. I know what you're talking about, but I can't think of the title either.
Yeah, it's a great film. I'm mad at myself as a film buff for not being able to spit that title right out. So, okay, so it's riddled with crime and what have you. And then when I went there, you discover, first and foremost, that you know it's a tremendously energetic, very vibrant city, like all other giant cities across the globe. Yes, it obviously must have its crime problem. It must have its, you know, garbage collection problems or whatever, but not in excess. And, you know, it's all there. All the stuff you expect from a big city is there. And you also come to realize that Naples is a big, it's a harbor city. And it's a crossroads city. It's situated in such a way that it's really a gateway city in and out of Italy by ship, by water. And that starts to kind of explain a little bit maybe, or at least become a kind of a metaphor for Enzo and his music, because he's a gateway crossroads musician. And this notion of sort of talent flowing into Naples from around the world, in addition to ships loaded with all kinds of stuff, kind of takes on a, and that may not be visible in the movie, although we have lots of shots of the gorgeous harbor. But that kind of had a lot of resonance for me, and it's also an ancient city. So when you see Enzo delving deep into ancient Neapolitan and ancient Italian musical instruments and idioms, you go, well, gosh, this really could happen maybe only in Naples, this unique kind of fusion of ancient history and crossroads of the world. There are other musicians in Naples who kind of work this fusion thing. There's a tremendous immigrant community from Africa, from the Middle East. So these include musicians who kind of come and start making their music in Naples and teaming up with Italian musicians. So you wind up with Enzo Avitabile, you know, like really maybe more than anyone, but certainly as much as anyone, you know, like capturing this new kind of the new potential of all this, these kind of elements, and creating this gorgeous music. There's a guy named Daniele Seppi who does the same thing. He works with musicians, you know, who arrive from different corners of the world in Naples. It's all very, there are many other bands that do this. They're huge sort of regiment bands with huge percussion corps and amazing woodwinds and stuff. So it's a great musical city. It's gorgeous. I hope that we captured the beauty of Naples in the film. So I love that place.
Mm. I think the movie that you're talking about, was it Gomorra?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. you talk about the eclectic nature of Enzo's music and utilizing great musical talents from across the world. When you consider your own work, are you aware of the influences that you're playing off from?
Maybe not. Well, wait. Yeah, I mean, you mean like stylistically and what have you?
Sure.
Definitely. I can encapsulate what that is. as a young starting out filmmaker, the quest was to be able to kind of achieve a style that really was a style of the old American movies or the American movies that I love so much, like films that would look and feel like the films of Howard Hawks or Raoul Walsh or William Wellman. Or then that starts to shift into, so that's where my energy went when I was learning to be a filmmaker while making films. I never went to film school. But I also had this great love for cinema verite, for the Nouvelle Vague, for the neorealism films from Italy. And then when I saw Mean Streets, I saw that Scorsese was this making this kind of very, very new wave kind of film set in New York with a lot of handheld camera and a lot of great energy to it. And that turned me on to the idea of kind of like trying to maybe evolve a style that would contain elements of the looseness of Nouvelle Vague along with the classicism, which I kept striving for. And as the budgets of my films got bigger and suddenly I could afford a crane and do crane shots, that was very exciting. But then at a certain point, I guess after I made Manchurian Candidate back in around 2005 or something like that, 2003, I sort of found myself really, really wanting to shoot films like the films that I was loving the most. So that meant the new Danish films and like Lars von Trier films and stuff like that, where they look gorgeous, but they have this incredible sense of spontaneity and unplannedness to them. Films like, for von Trier, like Dancer in the Dark, became a tremendous paradigm for me, and I was like, I would love to make a film that felt like that. And Before the Wedding, the Suzanne Blier film. So when I made Rachel Getting Married, I kind of like tried to pursue that style, and I really enjoyed that very much, having a lot less manipulative control over the camera. And I guess that was also an outgrowth of my love of documentary filmmaking, where you can't plan a bunch of fancy shots. You have to go in and capture what's going on with a spontaneous cinematic feeling to it. So in fact, when we made Rachel Getting Married, Declan Quinn, the great DP that I work with so much, with whom I've done so many documentaries, we just went, let's pretend we're making a documentary with this movie. We won't rehearse any shots. The actors won't know what the shots are going to be. Even you, Declan, won't know what it's going to be. Follow the action. Follow what's happening, and we'll never do the same shot twice. So I guess, and now I've been doing some work in television, and I just recently finished shooting a pilot, and surprise, surprise, I'm back to like enjoying the kind of more classical, manipulative style of filmmaking. I feel like the piece I just did, invited something that was kind of anti-cinema verite. So I'm influenced by the stuff I see, I guess. That long-winded answer. I guess I'm influenced by what I'm seeing and what I'm being turned on by.
Absolutely. And, I think that all of us are, whether we're in the arts or not, we're always influenced by certain people in our lives. I mean, you can't avoid it. It's part of being human. But in terms of the artist's process, I know that we take all of these influences and then we kind of filter them through our own experience and outcomes, something unique to us. But was there a moment when you realized your own identity as a filmmaker?
I sort of like, well, certainly there came a moment in time, probably back in the mid to late 90s, where I went, well, look at what I went from being a very, very low-budget exploitation filmmaker into trying to be kind of a Hollywood filmmaker. And somewhere along the line, I fell into performance films with Talking Heads and with Spalding Gray, and also with documentaries, because I started making documentaries in Haiti. And I thought, That's so interesting. I'm glad I'm like that. I'm glad I make fiction films. I'm glad I get to make performance films. And I'm and check it out. I'm making documentaries. And I by the time the most recent documentary that I made that was a straight documentary is called I'm Carolyn Parker. And that's a portrait of this amazing woman from New Orleans who I visited for about 5 years after the floods that followed Katrina, and documented how her life changed and her efforts to get back into her house. And that I shot myself with a little tiny camera, and it wound up on PBS and it wound up in film festivals. So that fascinates me about myself, that I never could have envisioned that there'd be that kind of strange evolution in my life. I always thought it was that I was so privileged to meet Roger Corman and have the opportunity to become this young filmmaker. And I thought, will I actually be able to do this my whole life? Can this be what I do in life? And, working hard, trying to improve each time, what have you, that happened. So I would have been happy just to get to make fiction movies for years. But I guess I self-identify in a positive way with having a variety of types of films that really turned me on.
Yeah. Before I let you go, your film on Enzo, it opens, I believe it opens today in New York City.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm sure that you are. I'm sure this is by design. But Stop Making Sense opened in New York City on this date.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. That's amazing. Really?
Isn't that
amazing?
Oh, my God. Yes. That's a beautiful symmetry. So I thought that was terrific. last question for you. Do you still have, when you look back at when you opened with Stop Making Sense and then you compare that to today, do you still have the same level of, what is it, nerves or anxiousness when you're unveiling your movie to an audience?
Oh, dear. It's the best excitement comes with the process. There's no doubt about it. Shooting, cutting, getting it finished. The anticipation of it opening is very exciting, and then it opens, and you just pray. If you're me, you just pray that someone's going to show up, and that the people that do show up find the picture enjoyable. So that is the same level as of nerves. Although I guess I'm thinking out loud here, and I have to say that Talking Heads were so culturally upfront back when we made that film. They were we made that film at the peak of their popularity, and they were no longer going to tour, so you had this extraordinary Talking Heads audience all over the world waiting, for the Talking Heads to show up again, and that meant us with our film. So I guess that was less nervousness than sheer excitement. With Enzo, that audience doesn't exist. So there's no pre-sale here, and again, it's an honor to just get any documentary into a movie theater, and you pray that it's going to do okay and justify the effort that the distributor and the exhibitors have gone through to make this showing possible. So I'm just really hoping some folks show up today.
Yeah. Well, they're in for a terrific film, and I got to tell you, I could talk to you for hours. Your work is so incredibly beautiful, and it's meant so much to me in my life.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that.